For 3 weeks now, it seems that everyone has been talking about The Traitors. Have you been watching it? It's a TV show where deception, being duplicitous, that's the game, and trust is constantly tested. Oh, it's such a good watch. But outside reality TV, lying is no game at all. And for police, it's a daily challenge. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And today we're going to find out from the expert how to separate truth from fabrication, instinct from actual real evidence, and performance from reality. So what really happens when deception enters a Garda interview room, for example, and are detectives trained to spot lies, a bit like the way a poker player, for example, can read tells or ticks? And how much of what we think we know, thanks to, like me, probably watching far too many television dramas, actually plays out in real investigations? Well, to answer those questions and so much more, I am delighted to be joined again by Geraldine Noon. You'll remember Geraldine as an investigator and forensic psychologist who spent decades in policing and helped bring killer Graham Dwyer to justice and took part in one of our first News Talk Daily podcasts. And if you get a chance, do go back and listen to it. I promise you it's a really fascinating listen. You're very welcome back to News Talk Daily, Geraldine.
Thank you, Ciara. Delighted to be here again.
Now, I know you're not a huge fan of reality television, but you very kindly agreed to go and watch The Traitors for us. So first and foremost, what did you make of it?
It is very entertaining, yes, fascinating watch as a social experiment. I suppose the most surprising thing about it is that people go into that show knowing that they're going to be dealing with somebody who's deceptive, and yet there's no real strategy or no research as to how to manage that and detect it. In fact, there was very few of the competitors who seem to have any good grasp of what a lie might look like and how they might detect it.
So were people recycling certain myths about what lying actually looks like?
Absolutely. And I suppose that's only natural. That's what is happening in the real world. Lee people have a very poor understanding of what a lie might look like and how they might detect it. In fact, it's only guesswork. We know from research that 50% of a guess at a lie, it's just right 50% of the time. It's a flip of a coin as to whether you're right or wrong when you're trying to figure out if somebody is lying. And that's for most of the population. It's only people who are very specifically trained, specialized skills in detecting lying that have a higher success rate, up to 90% with very, very high levels of skill. It's not unusual or it's not surprising that the participants in The Traitors would have difficulty doing their buying into the normal myths around lying.
Okay, so let's look first of all at some of the myths around lying, particularly, I suppose, the non-verbal cues that we all look out for. Oh, she was itching her nose. Oh, she took a little sip of water. Did you see that? When she took off her blindfold, she went straight for the water. Oh, she was playing with her hair. Oh, she was actually biting her bottom lip. Oh, he was looking off into the corner. He wouldn't make eye contact, right? I'd be reading all of those if I was in that situation going, "You're one's out and out, traitor." Are they all wrong?
They're all pretty bunkum, really. They are all wrong. Certainly, but they have huge, they're hugely common in the common parlance. And they come from this idea that when people are lying to us, they're going to feel guilt or shame about lying. So they're going to show the indicators of guilt and shame or some outward leak in their body. And of course, most people don't feel guilt or remorse when they're lying. In fact, as we know from the the competitors in The Traitors, they feel quite justified in lying and in trying to detect lies because it's part of the game. There is no one indicator of lies. There is no one Pinocchio's nose, as they say in the real world. There's no one reliable indicator of lying. It depends on the context, depends on the circumstances, it depends on personality, the stakes, all of those things come into play. But certainly the body language or the non-verbal behaviour is the least reliable.
That is actually quite misleading if the person is a good liar.
Absolutely. A good liar will watch their leaks. Good liar knows what the common understanding of what a lie looks like is. They know what people expect as a physical manifestation of a lie. So they will control those things. A good liar will be economical with the truth. They will lie as little as possible and lie about the things that are provable, rather stay away from the things that are provable. And they'll watch their nonverbal behavior, not because they believe it to indicate lying, but because they know other people will be watching out for them.
See, one thing I would have thought when I heard Ireland was doing the traitors and RTÉ were doing it, my initial instinct was, well, first of all, we all know each other, so that's going to be impossible. But second of all, I just didn't see Irish people as being really good liars. You know, we're a bit sort of noddy, winky, Irisher, you know, wink, wink. You know, that's how we lie in this country, I think, by and large. Am I totally wrong?
But it's not, his problem is, it's not just how we lie, it's how we engage in the world in general.
Go on, Geraldine.
Most Irish people are terribly talkative. And if you're talking, you're going to give yourself away if somebody allows you to continue to talk.
So that's our problem. It's not that we're bad liars, it's that we talk too much.
Yeah, the more you speak, the more you're likely to let yourself down eventually if somebody's listening to what you're saying. And you can see that, you could see that happening with the people who did lie. I mean, they were talking away and they said, oh, what are we going to do tonight? Didn't Eamon say that at one point? Because he was just talking.
Yeah. Have you picked your person for tonight?
Exactly. Something like that. Yeah, that's the discipline. Let's stay quiet. Let's just listen. Let's just over anxious over a need to impress and to be seen as one of the lads kind of thing.
So if you're then a bad liar, and I think there are people out there who are good liars and bad liars, if you're a bad liar, are you more likely then to engage in certain body language that gives it away?
I don't really buy into the concept of a bad liar. I think everybody can lie and can lie very well, depending on the stakes and the context in which they have to lie and to whom they're lying. For example, lying to police is a perfectly rational thing to do because there is no advantage to telling the truth. And there's no incentive to tell the truth. So anybody can be a good liar depending on what they're lying about and why they're lying. But yeah, I suppose people who have a nervous disposition, who are anxious already, certain vulnerable people, certainly some neurodiverse people, are going to have difficulty lying. And as they're lying, even parts of what they're telling, the truth that they're telling, will also look like a lie. I think that was very evident too in the traitors. You saw once people was accused of lying by another party, then they immediately began to look more and more suspicious, and it became a vicious cycle where everybody bought into the fact that they were lying, when in fact they weren't. They were just fighting for their place on the show.
Are there certain people, do you think, that find it easier to lie or are better at telling lies than others? Or do you think everybody can approach lying in the same way if the stakes are high?
Well, no, not everybody can't approach lying in the same way, but everybody can lie convincingly and potentially get away with it. But of course, there are very skilled liars. Of course, there are. I mean, if you think about our last podcast, then anybody who has high traits of psychopathy is probably going to be a good liar because, again, they're not going to have those nonverbal cues that might indicate lying because they're not feeling any fear, any remorse, either about the lie or about the thing it is they're lying about or about getting caught. They don't have that sense of fear. And it's the sense of fear or nervousness that gives the bodily indicators that look like lies.
So one of the interesting parts of the traitors is when all of the contestants at the very beginning meet Siobhan McSweeney and they have to tell her whether they want to be a traitor or would prefer to stay as a faithful. What would make somebody want to be a traitor in that programme and to lie for potentially 2 weeks to their fellow contestants as opposed to wanting to remain a faithful?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's a personality thing, isn't it? I mean, somebody who's an extrovert is going to want to be a traitor. There's more risk involved, there's more fun involved, and there's more to be gained from it and more to be lost as well. So people who are risk adverse and enjoy the game are going to want to be the traitor. Also, I mean, the incentive is to win a lot of money, isn't it? So, but certainly people who are, personality plays a big role, and somebody who's extroverted is more likely to want to be a traitor, whereas somebody who's a little bit introverted wants to stay in the group and have that safety around the group and still play their game within that comfort zone.
Are there certain personality types that overall will really thrive in that environment, whether they are a traitor or a faithful?
In the beginning, as you said, when everybody is telling Siobhan what they want to be, there's 24, so there's safety in numbers and it's a big group. It's as the numbers fall down that people are more likely to wonder about which role they should have taken and which role they should have accepted. I mean, there are personality types who certainly wouldn't like to be in a group of three making decisions about other people's fate. That would make them terribly uncomfortable. And they'd probably have a very poor sense of their own ability to carry that lie through with their fellow contestants next morning and as they're traveling in the car and all that stuff. So that would make certain personality types very uncomfortable for sure.
You said at the very beginning, Geraldine, that few people seem to have developed strategies for how to spot lies or catch traitors. They don't seem to have gone in there with a plan. So it's the Traitors season two and Geraldine Noon is a contestant. What would your strategy be?
Well, I thought early on in the contest, Nick seemed to be the only one with any really good understanding of how to play the game and what his strategy was. He said it very clearly from the word go, I'm just going to listen and I'm going to watch. And that's what you need to be doing. Most people are talking too much. They're asking their fellow contestants all sorts of questions as if they believe that's where they're going to get an indication as to what they are and how they behave normally. But listening and watching is the key strategy. You hear what people are saying. I mean, I thought the contestants missed so much in the conversations that would have given them an indication.
Like what?
So, I mean, it was clear Eamon was lying from the word go when he was talking about his profession. But everybody was too busy telling them about themselves and asking questions to really bore into that. I mean, they completely missed the relationship. And I know the thing is heavily edited. They completely missed the relationship between the father's son.
Poddy and...
And Andrew, exactly. Even the way they were engaging with each other, anytime we did see them on a clip, if somebody was really watching, they should have known there was some kind of a bond there, I think. But listening is key, and ask the question, just listen to the answer and let the person speak. Everybody's too anxious to get their own opinion in or their own version of events in.
And what was it about Eamon talking about his fake career that you think was such a give, that was such a tell that he was a traitor?
We just wouldn't go into any details, and he was quite, I mean, one of the key things that good liars do is they distract or disengage rather than giving more and more detail. And he distracted and talked about other people constantly or brought their attention to somebody else rather than himself. It's a good tactic. It didn't work for him because he wasn't that highly skilled at it. And of course, he was lying. Even though he gave himself a cover story of being a courier, he probably didn't give himself, rehearse that enough and give himself enough of a backstory. So lawyers will always have a good backstory. They always have a good reason. I mean, in the policing world, the lawyer will always have a good reason for any of the evidence that he anticipates the police might have, or he'll be able to explain it in some way, even if it's never presented, because he'll have given him or herself a backstory as to why they were in a particular place or near somewhere at a particular time or knew somebody or was in possession of some item that might be of interest. They always have a backstory and they have that well rehearsed because they've thought about it from the moment that they engaged in the offending behaviour, not the moment that they were being spoken to by the police. You know, they rehearsed it and they had it laid down in memory because that's why liars suffer. They don't have any script or any memory for the original event that they're trying to relate. So they have to make it up on the spur of the moment. And that's always going to cause what's called hot spots in the story and details and places that you can go back into looking for more information.
What are hot spots?
Hot spots are these inconsistencies in somebody's narrative, coupled potentially with non-verbal behaviour. So they're the leaks or the tells, as you call them. We call them hotspots because they don't indicate any one thing. They're just areas that we'd like to go back into and explore further. They give you a red flag or a hotspot, in other words.
They kind of raise a suspicion.
They raise a suspicion, or they're just an inconsistency or a contradiction to something that was said earlier or to known evidence. And there might be verbal slips. There might be a slight change in the story. There might be some non-verbal behavior as well that's inconsistent with baseline behavior. So baseline behavior is how people are behaving and what they're doing and what they're saying and how they're saying it when they're not talking about the red flag matter, the matter under scrutiny.
You talk about inconsistencies in people's stories, or if you were interviewing something and there was an inconsistency, that might be a hot spot that you might go back to. And definitely that is something that the faithful absolutely leap upon in The Traitors. But the truth is that a true story, Geraldine, isn't always consistent. That even when you're speaking the truth, there might still be inconsistencies in your story.
And there should be.
And there should be.
There should be, Kira, yes. And I mean, it's one of the real problems that victims of crime have a lot in trials or when they're being cross-examined. They get a lot of pressure around, why didn't they say this earlier? And they're mentioning something now that wasn't mentioned before. And that's used as an indication that their testimony isn't reliable. When in fact, it's not an indication of that at all. A witness who's, or anybody who's adding new pieces of information, can be just an indication that they're actually remembering more and that they've been given the opportunity to revisit the context in which the thing occurred. You know, they're going into new memory banks and coming up with periphery detail or specific details that just wasn't available to them previously. So it's a good sign when the story changes. But what I'm talking about is inconsistencies with the known evidence, inconsistencies around very specific detail that doesn't really change.
So times, dates, locations.
Times, dates, locations, things that only the offender or the suspect would know, you know, things that the investigator already has factual evidence around.
When somebody does tell a lie, particularly a kind of an elaborate lie, how does a good interrogator go about trying to dismantle that?
This is probably another common myth. You don't need to dismantle it. A good lie is great evidence because it's provable or disprovable, you know. We're obviously an investigator is a truth seeker. That's what they're there to find, the truth. But if somebody wants to give a lie as their story, that's absolutely fine. In fact, it would be very unethical not to accept that as their story. But what then happens is the evidence is presented and they're asked to explain that and as much information is drawn out from them as possible. You're always happy to get somebody in front of you who's speaking. That's the first thing. So if they're talking, let them talk, listen, really hear what they're saying. Be aware of the detail of what they're saying. Look for fine-grained detail around specific elements of the narrative or the story. Potentially get them to repeat it or tell different aspects of the story from different perspectives. All of those things help build those inconsistencies so that by the time those inconsistencies are presented to them, then they really are demonstrating lots of hotspots and lots of indicators that they're what you'd call under cognitive load. So lying is a very cognitively demanding process. It's up to the investigator to make it even more cognitively demanding. That's where the inconsistencies and the discrepancies kick in eventually. But it's a long process. What might happen is that the person begins to realize that process is unfolding. They withdraw their narrative or they reduce their narrative significantly because they're aware that something's been demanded of them that they cannot offer. So it's a very fine balance between keeping somebody talking and providing details and shutting somebody down.
What's really interesting actually in the traitors is not just that they have to tell this lie, you know, as soon as Siobhan picks out her three traitors and they immediately are all suspicious of each other, but that they have to sustain this lie over a period of time in what I would imagine is a pretty intense environment. And probably one of the most difficult places where you're trying to sustain this lie is at the round table, right? I absolutely love those scenes, even though they actually feel a little bit nauseous, because I think the thing we love about the traitors is we all can put ourselves into that environment. Once they're in that environment and their lie has been exposed, how quickly do suspects and indeed the traitors tend to give up the story?
Well, I mean, the traitors tend to give it up quite quickly, don't they? Again, it depends on what's in it for them, like all of us. What's the incentive for giving it up? Suspects in the real world rarely give it up. Once somebody has committed to a narrative or a story or a denial, it's very, very difficult to get them to move from that because psychologically they've committed to it and they would lose face. And that's probably where the shame would come from more than being caught in a lie. When people give an elaborate story, it's very difficult for them to go back then and say that actually that was all bunkum. Here's my real truth. That rarely, if ever, happens. In fact, I don't think it ever happens. What does happen is they might accept certain things were a mistake, or they misspoke, or they misunderstood the question, or actually they remember something differently now. But they rarely do a complete U-turn. That would be very difficult. And they certainly wouldn't do it under the shaming conditions where everybody has accused them of telling lies and everybody is on their case, so to speak. It would have to be in a very sensitive and empathetic environment that would happen.
Do you find, Geraldine, that sometimes when people tell a lie, if they repeat it enough, they actually nearly begin to believe the lie themselves has some element of truth to it?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a huge difficulty in investigations, particularly for witnesses or even victims. They actually come to believe certain things, especially come to believe certain things that they heard after the event, but that wasn't their true perception or understanding of the event at the time. And they absolutely come to believe that to be true through no fault of their own, really. It's just that a new memory and a false memory has been laid down. They come to believe it as their own now.
What often happens at the round table too, which I find so interesting, is that the contestants, the faithful, go in with a very clear idea of who they think is the traitor. They have all of their evidence there and they're, you know, no holds barred. They're going to give it to them this evening. And then somebody else at the table who's perhaps got a bigger personality or a more confident or more forceful personality will suggest a totally different character. And you can see this person change their mind and suddenly go with a completely different theory. What is going on there?
Absolutely. That happens a lot. And of course, there's a lot of groupthink going on there, but it's also a lot of the loudest voice syndrome and the more strong personality carrying the room eventually. But what's really happening is the theory isn't well founded. If your theory isn't well founded in evidence and it hasn't been tested and retested before you actually go to test it in the live environment, then it's going to fall apart very quickly. I mean, they don't have any evidence. They're looking at, as we said, the myths around lying, and they're looking at likability or dislikability or the offhand remark somebody said, but that doesn't hold water then when it's tested in the live environment and somebody else's theory that sounds more convincing takes over. But they're only theories.
If you had to pick a winner now, and I know we're only 7 episodes in, there's more to come, would you pick any particular individual? Who do you think is standing out?
I think there's nobody standing out as a winner at the moment, but I hope and I believe that the winner would be somebody who's playing a quiet game right now and that hasn't even come to the surface in terms of a likely person. Paddy isn't playing a bad game so far. He's quite good because he stays quiet and he's good at deflecting when he's confronted. He makes a joke or says something very self-deprecating, which is always a good sign in a liar. He's also likable. And you have to like a person in order to believe them. Even truthful people, if they're not liked, are more likely to be accused of lying. So it'll be somebody who's not really working hard at trying to persuade people at the moment. Somebody who's playing quite enough game, but is watching and listening and will come to the surface when the numbers are reduced down significantly.
Okay, so Geraldine, I'm now going to apply for the traitors next year because I have the tactics. And you need to go in, you need to be likable, friendly, don't talk
too
much. Not over friendly. This would be a big one for me. Don't talk too much and just observe. That is a challenge, but that's the key here.
Just observe and be, you know, use empathetic skills to draw people out and listen to what they're saying and watch. But don't pay too much attention to what they're doing non-verbally. It's the actual content of what they're saying and how they're saying it that's really important. But then that has to be in the context of a baseline. So you really need to get to know somebody a little bit outside. If you actually have a suspect, you need to get to know somebody outside of talking about others and talking about the game. You need to know what they're actually like as a person.
Okay. My God, I've got so much to learn, but I have taken so much from that, Geraldine. I'm going to just wrap this up very calmly because I will not be somebody who speaks too much anymore. Geraldine Nguyen, it's always lovely and so interesting to have you here on News Talk Daily. Thank you for your time and your expertise. Do, as I said, listen back to our first chat with Geraldine. It's called Unmasking Graeme Dwyer. You'll find it on the Go Loud Player or wherever you find your podcasts. That is it for today. We'll be back again tomorrow with another edition. Enjoy the traitors tonight, and we will see you tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.